which led to the Great Recession of 2008, and we're still clawing our way out of that. And according to the article, housing is about returned to pre-2008 levels. So that's all good news. But our problem isn't in building houses. It's in building homes. Anyone can build a house, but only God can build a home. And that isn't to say that non-Christians might not have a good marriage or that they can't have a good family. And it doesn't mean that every Christian has a good marriage or a strong family. But it does mean that for a family to be all that it can be, it takes God to build a home. Solomon says here in 127, Psalm 127, verse 1, he says, "Unless the Lord builds a house, the builders labor in vain." Now, in our extreme home makeover, we began last week by looking at the blueprints. If you're going to build a home, you need a good set of plans. And once you have your blueprints, the next stage, very important, it's a good foundation. It doesn't matter how big or luxurious your home is. If it isn't built on a solid foundation, it will fail. And I think the foundation for a Christian home is God's love. And that would be worthy of a whole sermon right there. But this morning, I want to move on to the next most important stage in building a home. And that is the framing. Because everything else flows from the framing. Your windows, your doors, your siding, your roof, all flow from the framing. And if you don't get the framing right, everything else is going to be wrong. I remember a few years ago, the church I was serving at, we were building a children's building. And we got to the stage where they had kind of the metal skeleton up. And they were starting to do all the framing. And they had framed in the entire first floor. And the builders that we hired were home builders. And this was their first time that they were venturing out doing a commercial project. And we were out looking at this one day, and we realized something seemed off. They had framed in the first floor using 8-foot walls, because that's the standard in home construction. But our plans called for 10-foot walls. They had to tear the whole thing down and start over. Because if the framing isn't right, everything else is going to be messed up. And as we continue with our extreme home makeover this morning, I want to deal with the framing of our homes. And I think the framing of the home deals with the children. And I want to talk this morning about the framing of values in our children. And I especially want to focus on the early childhood years. Next week's going to be my teenager sermon. I'm probably going to be sick next week and I won't preach that sermon. Just, you know, skip that one. So Kelly, be ready. But, you know, at least this is the one area of parenting I feel like I've got some experience here. But the early childhood, these are the active years. These are the years where it seems like you can see the changes in your children almost every single day. Physically, emotionally, mentally, they change right before your eyes. And parents, without question, these will be the years of the greatest impact you will have in the lives of your children. They will be the years you set the tone and the pattern that they will follow for the rest of their lives. But it's also the time when we as parents make some of our biggest mistakes. You know, because we're kind of still young and stupid ourselves when we're that age. And last time I checked, babies don't come with instructions. I've always joked, it'd be great, you know, baby comes out between the cheeks, pull out the little page of instructions. There you go. You know what you're doing now. But they don't. And I remember the first time I held Alyssa in my hands, my first thought was, God, got the wrong guy here. I'm not qualified for this. God, I hope you know what you're doing, because I don't. And so we make these mistakes. But I want to use this passage from Psalm 127 as a springboard. And I originally wanted to talk to you about three principles for framing values in our children. The first is direct your children spiritually. The second is discipline your children lovingly. The third is develop your children emotionally. But as I worked on the sermon this week, it got bigger and bigger, and I thought, well, either I'm going to have to divide this thing in half, or I'm just going to have to kind of focus on the areas with the biggest need. And so I'm going to just focus on the first two this morning. And the first is direct your children spiritually. And Solomon, who was the wise king of Israel, uses a couple of key words here to describe children. And he says, children are a heritage from the Lord, offspring a reward from Him. Now, baby, your Bible says children are a gift from the Lord. And this Hebrew word that is translated as heritage or gift literally means possession. Now, this doesn't mean that your children are personal property. What it means is your children are a possession of the Lord. And that we as parents have been entrusted by God with some of His most valued possessions. And we've been called to love them, care for them, nurture them, and raise them in a godly home. These children that are created in His image, in His likeness. And that means that children aren't just born from below, they are a gift from above. They're not just the product of some biological processes here on earth. Well, the egg fertilizes the sperm and forms a zygote and it divides and yada, yada, yada. That's not all children are. They are so much more. And notice what he says in verse 4. This is sort of the foundation for the whole sermon here. It says, like arrows in the hands of a warrior. Somebody saw this earlier, but I better not fall asleep today in church. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are children born in one's youth. Now, I didn't get started into archery till about 3 years ago. And even then it was with a crossbow. And I, when I moved to Missouri here, I had to switch to the compound bow. But even in my short time, I've learned a secret about archery. And do you want to know what my secret is? This is profound. This is deep. Those of you who are hunters might want to write this down. But here's my secret. The arrow must be shot in the right direction. Told you it was profound. But it's important, and here's how I know this, because when I switched to the compound bow, I could go out in my backyard, and Terry, I was getting them all, it looks sharp. And then I head out to your woods, and something was happening. You know, the first couple shots I took at a deer, I missed completely. Well, not completely. I wounded one enough for Elizabeth to get a shot at later, but you know. I couldn't figure out what was going on, but what was happening was I was misjudging the distance. And so I wasn't having the elevation of my bow just right. And so I got a rangefinder out there, got my bearings straight, got my distances lined out. I set little rocks out, you know, 20 yards, 30 yards, so I knew. And boom. Landed the arrow right on the target. You have to shoot the arrow in the right direction. Now, obviously, when it comes to archery, that's obvious. You don't have to say it, right? But the same thing is true when it comes to our children. Our job as parents is to make sure from the time that they are born that we are aiming our kids in the right direction. And the right direction is more than just a good education. It's more than that they're just good, productive members of society. We need to direct them toward eternity and a relationship with God. Now, if your children are the arrow, then who is the archer? Who is the warrior? You are. Moms and dads are the archer. We're the ones that launch our children in the right direction. No one else. It's our job. But the tragedy today is that many children are being launched without being carefully aimed. Many children are given little to no spiritual direction by their parents. They're like the arrow in this little poem. I shot an arrow in the air. When it landed, I know not where. And there is a parenting philosophy that's very popular in our culture. This hit the mainstream about 70 years ago. A guy by the name of Dr. Spock, no connection to the pointy-eared guy, but he wrote a book called The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care. And this book hit the market in 1946, just in time for a massive baby boom. And we've now had four or five generations of kids raised on this philosophy. Now, to be fair to him, Dr. Spock was responding to a rather cold, authoritarian, distant style of parenting that was very popular in the 1940s and before. Parents were actually told to withhold affection from their children. They were told that it was important not to touch them too much. The problem is that Dr. Spock took the pendulum from that extreme all the way to the other extreme, to a very indulgent style of parenting. And the philosophy was basically this, that the child will thrive and flourish on their own if the parents and the culture just don't mess them up. And so it's our job as a parent to just get out of the way. And that as the parent, what you really need to do is whatever natural inclination the child has, whatever natural thing they want to do, you need to nourish that and encourage it and help them pursue that. And if you do that, the child will thrive and do very well. One article I read described the impact of the book this way. Instead of stressing the importance of teaching self-denial and respect for authority, Spock discouraged directive training and emphasized accommodating children's feelings and catering to their preferences. No longer did children learn that they could endure Brussels sprouts and suffer through daily chores. Using Spock's approach, parents began to feed their self-indulgence instead of instilling self-control. Homes were becoming child-centered. As parents elevated children's freedom of expression and their natural cravings, children became more outspoken, defiant, and demanding of gratification. In fact, they came to view gratification as a right. Now, the problem with this philosophy is that it assumes that children are born basically good. But what does the Bible say? The Bible says that everyone in this room, you and I, we are born with what? With a sinful nature. That we are not just naturally good, but naturally we are selfish and rebellious, and we have a bent towards sinning. That's why two of the first words that little children learn are no and mine. It's that natural selfishness. And it's the job of parents to put some guardrails and some controls on that so that that sinful nature doesn't just flow out of control. One thing I have learned about archery is this. Almost everything that determines where an arrow hits happens before the arrow ever leaves the bow. There's the proper setup of the bow. You have to have the proper posture, the proper stance, the proper form, releasing the arrow and then having the proper follow through. And all of that determines whether or not the arrow hits the target. And all of that happens before the arrow leaves the bow. In fact, most of it happens before you ever release it. I mean, if you had a good observer, they could look at you and tell you before you ever release the arrow whether or not that arrow is going to hit the target. Children are no different. Almost everything that affects how a child ends up as an adult happens before the age of 7. Now, obviously, we need to leave room for the miraculous intervention of God. Because God's grace can enter the picture at any stage in life and rewrite the script. So no matter how hopeless the situation, there is always hope. apart from the grace of God, what we found is that these things are pretty much set and determined at a very early age. One study followed 1,000 children born in the United States, Great Britain, and New Zealand. Followed them for a number of years, and what they found was that their adult character, their sense of right and wrong, and their moral compass was set by the age of, anybody want to guess? 3. The age of 3. Another study found that the adult personality was mostly set by the age of 3 and fully set by the age of 7. And this is not just a couple of things. I got study after study. I've got several I footnoted here on the bottom of my sermon. And if you want to look at those, I put this online every Monday. But if these studies are accurate, it suggests that the most critical strategic years in raising your children are those earliest years. And if that's the case, where should we focus the bulk of our parenting efforts? Now, I've already told you next week is the teenager sermon, but do you want to know the truth? Here's my opinion. The time to raise teenagers is not when they're 14, 15, 16 years old. The time to raise teenagers is before they're 5. If you wait until somebody is 16 and start trying to correct things then, you're going to fail most of the time. But if you succeed before they're 5, they will succeed for the rest of their life. Please understand that parenting is more than conceiving a child, feeding a child, clothing a child, educating a child, and then sending that child out to live on their own. We have the responsibility of shooting our children toward eternity. Moms and dads, you are the spiritual leaders in your home. And it is your responsibility as the warrior, as the archer, to launch those children toward a relationship with God and to direct their lives spiritually. So I just want to give you some practical things. These aren't rules carved in stone, handed down from Sinai. These are just based on my wife and I's, our experience and our observation. But number one, read the Bible to your children. Beginning when they are very, very young. I mean, our girls had a picture Bible. Just basic, not a whole lot of words, just a picture Bible. But we would read that to them every day. And as they got a little bit older, we would get story Bibles and other things that were written at a level they could understand. And I remember that we have this video. I would show it, except Alyssa would kill me. But she's about, 2-3 years old. She's standing in the living room in her diapers at the coffee table, and she's got her children's Bible out. And she's telling a Bible story. We have been doing the story of Moses, let my people go. Except when I read the story, it was always in this deep voice, let my people go. Because, that would intimidate Pharaoh, right? Well, so she's doing this, but she's doing her own version of it, and she would flip a page, ready to go. And she'd flip a page, ready to go, ready to go. And we're watching from around the corner with the video camera, hoping she doesn't see us, because it was so cute. But you instill these things at the earliest age. Dr. Seuss is just fine. We read a lot of Brown Bear, Brown Bear. But the Bible stories, the children's Bibles, that's so important. Number two, pray for your children and pray with them. Make that a part of your daily routine. And not just praying with them, but praying for them. For us, this was a nightly routine. We had about a 35, 40-minute kind of tuck-in routine that we did where we would read, we would pray, we would sing Jesus Loves Me. And hear them. Let them hear you. Pray for them. Pray for their decisions. Pray for wisdom. Pray for their future spouses. Pray for their purity. Number three, take every opportunity to teach them spiritual lessons. I kind of struggled with a clever way of wording this, but I think that's just what you do. Every day is filled with opportunities to teach spiritual truth. We just have to open our eyes to it. Whether it's a beautiful sunset or you're at Walmart and somebody drops a $20 bill and you pick it up, and what do you do with that? That's a spiritual lesson. And not just what do you do with it, but how do you explain what you do with it to your children? Number four, as you take your children to church, explain not only what we're doing, but why we're doing it. What's offering all about? Why do we do that? What's the baptistry all about? What's that for? What's communion all about? Why do we take communion? And children need to know it's more than just a snack. If it's just a snack, we ought to serve something different. That's what I'm saying. Next one, be sensitive to their spiritual questions. Take the time to answer them thoroughly. Sometimes when our kids ask questions and maybe we're distracted or whatever and we want to blow them off. Don't do that. Take the time to answer their questions in a way they can understand. Number six, expose them to Christian media. Have Christian DVDs and our Blu-rays or videos on their tablets. Don't raise your children only on Disney, please. Nothing against Frozen, you know. But there needs to be more than that. And Teresa and I will tell you, two of the greatest assets we had as parents were Bob the Tomato and Larry the Cucumber. VeggieTales were of immense help to us. I mean, they taught Bible stories and Bible truths in some of the most entertaining ways. And it's funny now, our girls are 16 and 20, and we're still dropping VeggieTale one-liners. You know, from videos we haven't seen in 10 years. And there's one great resource I want to recommend it to families. It's called Right Now Media. They have a website, rightnowmedia.org. It's like Netflix for Christians. And there are tons of resources on there for parents, for families, for children. Fantastic resource. Last one, and this one comes from my wife, and she's absolutely right. Family dinner. A recent Gallup poll says that only 28% of American families eat dinner together. We in the church need to make that number higher. It kind of becomes that one gathering point where you can do a lot of these other things. You can pray together. You can talk about the events of the day and teach spiritual lessons. The family dinner is very important. I'd heard about a man that had argued with the English poet Samuel Coleridge about the place of religious instruction in the children's life. And this man was making the point. He says, I don't think parents should indoctrinate their children in religion. Instead, they should give children the freedom to make their own choices. Coleridge didn't respond. Instead, he invited the man into his backyard to take a look at his garden. And the man looked kind of bewildered and confused. He says, that's not a garden. It's a bunch of overgrown weeds. And Coleridge says, well, it used to be a garden. But I decided to give it the freedom to become whatever it wanted to without any interference from me. If you choose not to cultivate your children's lives in a spiritual direction, Satan will be more than happy to fill their lives with all the weeds of the world. Number two, discipline your children lovingly. Remember that children are called arrows. Now, sometimes you can do everything right in shooting an arrow, but it still ends up off target. I remember warming up for hunting season this last year, and I would get three arrows right in a nice little group, but there'd be this fourth one way over here. And I'm like, what's up with that? And then I looked at my arrow, and I noticed that one of my veins was broken, and I had to replace it. Another time, one of my broadheads was messed up. It had to be replaced. It's no different with our children. There are things that need correction and things that need to be fixed. And if we want to launch our children in the right direction, then they need to be disciplined lovingly. And let me just give you kind of four pointers here. By no means is this exhaustive, but we have found these things to be very helpful. And number one, and it comes right from the title of this point, but it must come from a place of love. Discipline must come from a place of love. Proverbs 3:11-12 says, my son, do not despise the Lord's discipline and do not resent his rebuke, because the Lord disciplines those he loves. As a father, the son he delights in. Notice two things from that text. God disciplines us, since we are his children. And why does he do that discipline? Because He loves us. That's why He does it. And it comes out of love. So when you are madder than blazes, probably not the time to come up with what punishment you're gonna have for your children. Dr. James Dobson puts it this way. He says, the parent must convince himself that punishment is not something he does to the child, it's something he does for the child. His attitude toward his disobedient child is this: I love you too much to let you behave like that. And so discipline shouldn't be done in anger or the heat of the moment. There is nothing vengeful about loving discipline. The object is not to hurt them emotionally or physically or psychologically. It's to change them. And not just to change the behavior, but to shape the heart. Number two, discipline needs to be consistent. And this is probably the area where people mess up the most today. But if there is a rule, that rule needs to be enforced all the time, every time. And this is especially true when the kids are little. As they get older, there might be room for some nuance there. But when they're little, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, don't draw a line in the sand if you're not going to defend it. I'll give you an example. We have a dog. Her name is Millie. And there is a rule in our house. The dog doesn't get on the bed. And so Teresa will come into the room, and I'm laying on the bed reading a book, and Millie's sleeping at the foot of the bed, on the bed. And she'll say, what's the dog doing on the bed? She's not to be on the bed. Get down, Millie. Millie gets down. Then I'll come in later. Teresa's laying on the bed. The dog's all sprawled out next to her. She's rubbing the dog's belly. And I'm like, what's the dog doing on the bed? And Teresa says, but she was so cute. Now let me ask you a question. How well do you think Millie does obeying that rule? She doesn't. Because there's no consistency. And if you think your 3 or 4-year-old is any different, no. It'll be the same exact thing. And if you don't enforce the rule because you're too tired or you're too busy or you just don't want to mess with it, you're sending mixed messages to your children. And so if the rule is you don't mess with the TV remote in the living room, there need to be consequences for that every time. Now, my third thing is directly related to that. And this is the principle of first-time obedience. First-time obedience. And that is that children can be and should be expected to obey the first time. Remember as a kid, I had a friend, and his parents had this disciplining philosophy, but whenever he got in trouble, he got 3 warnings. There was no enforcement without 3 warnings. Well, guess what he did for the first 3 times? He completely ignored whatever mom or dad said. Because he knew for 3 times nothing would happen. Now, the parents were very proud of their disciplining program. I mean, they even bragged about it to other families in the church. What they didn't realize is they were teaching their son to disobey them 75% of the time. Now, sometimes we don't do it by design. It's just what happens. A lot of kids grow up learning that, well, we don't really have to listen to mom unless she gets really mad, We don't have to listen to dad till he starts yelling and steam's coming out of his ears. And this is a life and death situation, folks. Imagine this scenario. You're working out in the front yard. Your child's playing with their ball or they're riding a scooter in the driveway and they start heading toward the road. And from where you are, you look out and you can see a vehicle coming. And you shout, stop! But your child has been trying to ignore you the first 2 or 3 times you say anything. How does that story end? Finally, focus on the natural consequences or the logical consequences. God's Word teaches us that God created this world, that actions have consequences. Scientifically, we call it the law of cause and effect. Biblically, we call it sowing and reaping. Galatians 6:7 says that a man reaps what he sows. And this is built into life. And the earlier kids learn it, the better. I mean, as an adult, If you decide you would rather sleep in than go to work on time and you do that for 3 weeks in a row, is your boss going to A, give you a raise, B, tell you to take a vacation to catch up on your rest, or C, find a new job? It's a natural consequence to the action. Now, this applies to kids, and some of it's just built into life. I mean, you probably have a rule in your house, don't touch the stove. Pretty reasonable rule, right? And how many times does a kid disobey that before they learn the lesson? It takes one real painful occasion. But we need to show that there are natural or logical consequences to all sorts of behaviors. For instance, you tell your child to put away a toy. Let's say it's a Thomas the Train Engine set. And you tell him to put it away. And 10 minutes later, you come back into the room and it's not been touched. What do you do? Well, number one, you go over and you get the child and you make him pick it up. Even if you have to sit there and do it with him the whole time. And then a logical consequence would be you don't get to play with that train set for a whole day. And you put it up where they can't see it. And it doesn't come down for 24 hours. It doesn't matter how much they cry. It doesn't matter how much they scream. It doesn't matter how much they beg or how much they promise to be good. It doesn't come down. They need to learn there are consequences to the actions. Now, I don't want to give you a bunch of one-size-fits-all solutions because that would be misleading. Every child is different. I mean, with one child, a stern word might lead them to a cascade of tears. And they'll never do it again. Another child, a spanking is just the price of admission. So, you know, it'll take some creativity and some exploration to find out what works for each child and what speaks to their heart. But I do want to deal with this whole question of spanking. And if I was a smart preacher, I probably would just end the sermon right here. But I am going to say this. And I know people have strong feelings on this subject, and many regard spanking as abusive. And I'll be the first to admit that many times the way it is done is abusive. Because it isn't done from a place of love. It isn't done with consistency in mind. It isn't done to shape the heart. But the bottom line is this. I support spanking because the Bible does. And I'm not saying it is the right answer every time. It certainly is not, but it does have a role to play. Proverbs 13:24, he who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is careful to discipline him. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child, according to Proverbs 22:15, but the rod of discipline will drive it far from him. And the truth is, if you don't mind that your children don't mind, they won't mind. And think about this. If you're one of the parents that decides, I'm not going to have that tool in my discipline toolbox, and you take that out, and it's not available to you. What I have found is that many of the families who have done that, you know what tools they're using instead? Nagging, begging, belittling, yelling. Those tools don't work. That's why God talks about the rod. But let me clarify for you what I mean by spanking. Spanking is most useful with toddlers and preschoolers from about 18 months to 6 years of age. And I definitely am not talking about physical abuse. And let me tell you the differences. The spanking is just a few swats on the bottom. Physical abuse is beating, kicking, punching, especially in other parts of the body. Spanking has the intent of training and shaping the heart. Abuse has the intent to harm them. The attitude of spanking is love and concern. The attitude of physical abuse is anger and malice. The effects of spanking is proper behavior. The effects of abuse is emotional and physical injury and bitterness. And it's not something that's done in the spur of the moment. It's something that's done by design. The child knows ahead of time. This is the consequence for this action. My mom actually had a chart on the back of our pantry door. And it had a list of offenses and how many swats each offense was worth. So So we knew, I'm fighting with my sister, boom, three swats. Just, I knew that right from the get-go. And Mom didn't have to do it because she was mad or whatever. It was just the design. I know parents, it seems like sometimes we're fighting an uphill battle here. And I know that the sermons like this can seem like I'm putting a lot of weight of responsibility on your shoulders. But if you go all the way back to Psalm 127, verse 1, where he says, unless the Lord builds the house. Ultimately, this is not about what we do by our own strength. It's what we allow God to do through us. And there are times as parents you feel like, oh, I can't take anymore. You know, our children wear us down, and that's where we have to go to God and ask for His strength and His help. But what I want to get across this morning is that it's worth it. It's worth it. If you work at it really hard when they are one and two and three and four, and you fight some of those battles till you're exhausted, it's pretty much smooth sailing after that. Fighting and win those battles early. So those of you who are parents of young children or grandparents of young children, take seriously your call to direct them spiritually, to discipline them lovingly. Because it's worth doing. And it can shape a child for the rest of their lives, and not only for the rest of their earthly lives, but it prepares them for eternity. And we need Christian homes and Christian parents who are going to take this call seriously. That's how we're going to change the next generation. That's how we're going to shape our culture. Praise and worship team is going to come up here and lead us in a song of invitation and commitment. And I want to reiterate what I was saying before. We want to give you an opportunity to respond. And maybe, you know, moms and dads, maybe you're fighting some battles with your kids. You're really struggling with this whole parenting thing and you need some prayer. Pat Theobald, one of our elders, he's going to be back here. And if you want to spend some time in prayer, Pat's going to be back there. Our prayer bench is back in this section. And if you just need to spend some time in prayer with God, with your husband or your wife, we invite you to come back and pray. The other thing, I'm going to be through these doors right here. And if you're looking to make a decision today, you want to receive Christ as your Lord and Savior, you have questions about baptism, you want to make Sunrise your church home, please feel free. You can come in there and talk to me. And we will have some time to talk and answer your questions. And this is open to the teenagers and our youth, too. I'm going to ask Kelly that he would be through these doors back here. So if you need to talk or pray or whatever with any one of us, we just invite you to come and do that while we sing this song of invitation and commitment. So I'm going to turn it over to our worship team. And Kelly, if you'll head that way, and I'll go this way. Let's stand as we sing.
Sorry, I'm going to have to start this over. Softly and tenderly, Jesus.